This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Adams is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of this show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas had 18 executions last year, funded by taxpayers to the tune of some $40 million. Join us now as we provide coverage and analysis of the lethal injection killing of Timothy Adams in Huntsville, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Ruback, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Juan Melendez, who was exonerated after nearly 18 years on Florida's death row. The Execution Watch begins.
And here we are. My name is Ray Hill, and I am hosting tonight's program. With me is Jim Skelton, and we've also got Susan Asher in the studio in case we need to fall back on her. She's a good input. This is our first broadcast version of this. We have been doing these shows for well over a year, and we have been doing them on KPFT's HD channel. Tonight you're hearing it live on KPFT Broadcast and HD1 channel. We will also continue our effort here on executionwatch.org, our comprehensive website where you can get all of the history of the things that we've done. Timothy Adams is 42 years old, and he is condemned in the 2002 shooting death of his infant son, I believe 19-month-old son, here in Houston following a standoff with police after his wife threatened a divorce. As usual, when we do these things, we're waiting for word from Huntsville that the proceedings are going, and I see that that our producer, who is done, incidentally, our producer in the first voice you heard today is Elizabeth Stein. This whole thing is possible because of the wizardry of Otis McClay. And then we have the music comes from Victoria Panetti. As soon as Elizabeth gives us the word, we will find out what is happening in Huntsville. Traditionally, what happens in Execution Watch coverage is we get word from Huntsville that they have crossed the road with the witnesses. That sounds ominous, and what it actually amounts to is the witnesses for the person scheduled to be executed and the media crossed the road from the old administration building to the walls unit where the death house is located. And if that is in process, that means that this execution is going to go forward. There's always the possibility of a last-minute appeal working, and we're getting a delay. I think the clemency issue has already been resolved, and though there were some things filed late, there's no reason to expect this in this. Elizabeth, you might try the blinking lights. Maybe that is Gloria. And so we will see. They're trying to get Gloria connected so that we can proceed with tonight's thing. The Execution Watch program is always a little bit loose around the edges because we have turned this program into a evolving breaking news story when last minute stays do happen. So we come in here thinking we're well presented. The way this functions to all of those of you who are listening in our broadcast audience is that we will cover the case involving Timothy Adams. Jim Skelton will tell the story and go over the legal history about that. We always have someone in to tell us a little something about executions from a deeper perspective. And tonight that is Juan Melendez, who was exonerated from Florida's death row. He was sent there for a good many years. And you get a lot of publicity about how people are very well and generously treated whenever they've been wrongfully convicted. That is not true of Mr. Melendez's case, and it has not been true of other recent cases that come over. We were hoping to have a Mr. Graves on tonight's show, but his lawyers thought that was ill-advised as long as there is pending litigation concerning his being compensated for his time in prison, and we always bow to the needs of the lawyer. Well, Elizabeth is going through that, Jim, at the risk of everybody. We're ready to go, and so I think that we have Gloria on the phone. Gloria, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Ray. Hi, how are you doing?
What is going on in Huntsville?
Well, nothing is going on, which is good news. There are still appeals pending before the Supreme Court, and none of the media or witnesses has crossed the street. So we've got a large crowd of people out here.
Really?
Yeah, there's about, 30 people. There's a group of students, about 10 or 15 students, I guess, from Sam Houston. And
yeah.
Somebody from Dallas, New Mexico, Houston. In fact, we have an international contingent here tonight. We have Puerto Rican, Mexican, Colombian, and Venezuelans with it. Oh, God.
What has happened?
The media is walking across the street.
Media is walking across the street.
No.
Now, the reason this is upsetting to Gloria, let me explain to the audience. This is our first time to actually live broadcast on broadcast cable, on broadcast radio. We've been doing this on HD2 channel, so now we have the good folks. And the reason Gloria is upset about the crossing is that is the first sign Normally, it is 6:09.
Favor and go tell Liliana.
Normally, that would have already happened. But tonight, apparently, the crossing of the street is delayed. Gloria, are you anticipating witnesses for the for Mr. Adams?
Yeah, I was just talking with his son and cousin and aunt and uncle, and oh God, his aunt's freaking out. And they said, yeah, his mom, dad, sister, and brother, and his boss are all in there witnessing. And his ex-wife is a witness for the...
For the other side.
Yeah.
Okay, now, has he... have they actually crossed the road, the witnesses?
I haven't... I don't know if I missed them talking to you. No, I haven't seen the witnesses. But
okay.
The media definitely.
But the media has gone across, and it's usually the media followed quickly by the witnesses as they go across the street. This is so ritualized, and for those of you listening to the Execution Watch for the first time, it is not unusual for us to describe the ritual as it is. Gloria, I think we're going to cut back to the studio and have Jim explain the case to the listeners. If anything happens, call Elizabeth on her walkie-talkie, because
okay,
I don't know how diligent...
We're actually on the air tonight?
We're actually on KPFT broadcast.
Oh, I think that's great.
Yes,
people
and...
You get to hear what's going on. I mean, we have family members out here. His aunt is over there just crying her heart out.
Okay, well, we will come back to you as things progress, but we're going to assume that the process has begun, and
okay.
We're going to cover the case, and then we'll be back to you if anything happens. Use Elizabeth's cell phone, because I don't know how reliably she's going to punch up the buttons on this system. Okay?
Okay, all right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Gloria. And so now, Jim, we have reached the point where we can continue.
Well, Ray, you had mentioned that we've been doing these shows for a number of years, and this is really the most unusual of all the death penalty cases we've ever talked about. It's extremely different. The reason being, number one, pardon me, I got a bit of a cold. Number one, Timothy came from a very sound family here in Houston. He was born and reared here in Houston. His father worked in the fire department. His father was a veteran of Vietnam. Came back and went to work for the fire department. Ended up being a fire marshal, apparently, from all appearances, had a very stable, loving home. Pardon me. Went to church. They were very stable people. Timothy completed high school and never got in trouble. High school teacher seemed to love him. Claimed he was no problem. After he got out of high school, he joined the Army and served a tour in Germany. Apparently had no problems at all in the Army at all. And came back to Houston. And that's what's unusual, because you often see people on death row that come from broken homes. There's no indication of any child abuse. There's no indication that you normally see in these cases. And what's even more unique, I've never seen this before in any case I've ever covered, except with Lawrence O'Brien. He had never had no prior convictions. In fact, had never, ever been arrested prior to this event. Because normally, as you well know, when we cover these cases, it's somebody that's been out TDC or somebody's been in trouble all their lives. This guy had not even been arrested when this occurred.
Did he have his own military background? Was he in the military?
Yes. He served in the Army, served in Germany. And apparently everybody liked him over there. He got all sorts of nice recommendations from the people involved in the Army. The people at work loved him. And what he did when he came back here, he went to work for a security company. And he was working in a security company out at Green Bay Plaza, and they put him in charge as supervisor of all those other security officers. They liked him that well. And this is what's so unusual. He had a marvelous employment record, no records of juvenile problems, no records of family problems, no record with the law. And that was one of the big issues at trial, was whether or not he'd be a future danger. Because if you recall, we've only had one other case like this where somebody had never been in trouble for, and that was the famous candy man, Lawrence O'Brien. But that was a little bit different than this. So that's what makes it really unique, in the fact that he came from a very stable home. Number two, had absolutely no criminal history. And the next thing that makes this case unique, and you rarely ever see this in death penalty cases, the lawyers had him enter a plea of guilty to the capital murder charges. And when you do this, it's kind of a dice roll, and I'm not being critical of them. They may very well have done the same thing because the case was almost impossible to win. I'll explain that in just a moment. But they entered a guilty plea, and the problem with that, when you enter a guilty plea, you virtually waive everything on appeal except what issues happen at punishment.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons the appellate process, I've had no hope for the appellate process, because when you enter a plea of guilty, that's the same thing as a judicial confession. And there's very little that appellate lawyers can work with, and they take it up on appeal. And that's the third thing that makes it very unique is that he entered a plea of guilty to the capital murder charges. Now, here's what basically happened. He had married a woman after he came back from the Army named Emma. And Emma and he had a son that's named Tim Jr., and that was the one that was killed in this case. And apparently his private life was not as settled as his public life was, because apparently there's a lot of turmoil in the home. The turmoil was testified to by his parents plus family friends who tried to intervene, and apparently there's a whole bunch of conflict. And what Emma claimed, now whether this is true or not true, what she claimed was that he was mentally abusive to her. I wouldn't give her money for the children. A lot of times there was not food at home for the children. And, of course, he denies all of this. Nonetheless, there were a lot of conflicts in the home. And apparently what really kicked off everything, about four or five days before the murder occurred, Tim bought a gun and brought it home. And Emma found the gun, found out that he had bought a gun. And I guess the fact that he had so many arguments and disputes, this scared her. She said she was going to move out. So at this point, she moves out. You need to take something. You ought to man on hold.
No. Well, we can do this.
We'll pick it up.
You can do this. Just hold on just a second. Dave, are you there? Dave.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you tell us what is where are you and what's going on there?
We're the corner of Binns and Main, right across from the Museum of Fine Arts, and we've got a. Not a big group, about a half a dozen people out here protesting today. Also a good response from everybody that's going by. This is, I think anybody that knows anything about this case realizes that this is one that, no matter what, I mean, this we shouldn't be executing Timothy Adams in view of everything that we know about his case.
Yeah, we were just explaining that to the audience, but... Let me ask you a question. Do you have the impression that many of the people who are driving by and reading the signs opposed to execution know what this case is about, or do you think that the population at large is oblivious about this
case? I think probably the population at large is oblivious. I think when we get a thumbs up on our, and we get lots of people that honk and thumbs up, but I think it's basically against the death penalty in general. I don't think it's to do so much with Timothy Adams' case, because I just don't think that this registers enough on individual cases in people's minds. These people are coming and going from work, a lot of them, rush hour traffic, and so I just don't think that this particular case, I think if people knew about this case and knew all the details of it and knew about the trial and knew about what the Adams family wanted and... all these problems, the problems with the jurors and everything, I think they would, a lot of people would oppose this. And, I don't think most of them know these details, quite frankly.
Dave, who do you have with you?
Well, we've got, Burnham Terrell, who's always here, with his wife Joan. We've got, Reverend Bruce Felker, who's a Methodist minister.
So you actually have Wesleyans out there on that sidewalk?
Yeah.
Okay. Good Catholic folks and some Wesleyans.
We got some Wesleys and we got a few other scattered. We got Burnham's a Quaker. So we got a good variety of faiths out here, yeah.
Well, we're going to continue telling the elaborate story of what's going on here, Dave, but we wish you well. And
okay.
We'll be back in touch with you later in the show.
Okay, good. You take care.
Thank you, sir. And that was our vigilant, Dave Atwood, who's at the corner of Main and Benz. That's big Methodist church. And he's got with him Wesleyans, Catholics, and Quakers opposed to execution. And, Jim, you were continuing.
Right.
What problems were there?
Well, what happened, like, when she found out that he had bought a gun, I guess that spooked her, and she decided to move out, and she moved in with a friend. Well, living at the house at the time, Emma had a son by a prior relationship, a 15-year-old boy by the name of Andrew. So when she moved out, she took Andrew with him, plus Tim Jr., the 19-month-old baby, and she moves out. And moves out of the apartment. Well, then you have the process of her calling him back up and going back and forth to the apartment to get clothing and things. And he agreed to it. He just said, fine, come on by and get the clothing. And for about a period over 4 or 5 days, she's coming back fairly often, picking up things to move out. And all this occurred on Wednesday, on February the 20th, and she had to go back to the house, and she claimed that she needed to go back to the apartment to pick up some things, and that she was going over there after Andrew got out of school. He's going to help her pick up the rest of her things. And Timothy agreed to that. And so what happened, Andrew, the 15-year-old son by the prior relationship, Emma's son, arrived there early. When she arrived, he arrived at the apartment. Tim was there. He had not been there on other occasions when they picked up things. And at this time, Tim had the gun with him. And there was a confrontation between Andrew and Tim, in which Tim accused Andrew of stealing a bunch of his videotapes. He was very angry about, apparently they were taking some of his tapes when they were moving out, or they claimed he stole some videotapes. About this time, Emma came in with a 19-year-old boy.
And 19-month-old
child, and saw Tim with a gun, and saw Andrew there, and he told, and Timothy Sr. tells Andrew to confess to his mother he had been stealing tapes. And then there was an argument at that point. When Emma sees the gun, she starts to call 911. At that time, Tim shoots at her, and bullet glazes, goes through her clothing, grazes the back of her back, didn't hit her, just grazed her. And she grabbed the 19-month-old baby. Well, she tried to grab the 19-month-old baby. That time, Tim had the 19-month-old baby. She grabbed Andrew, and they fled the apartment. After they left the apartment, Andrew goes back and beats on the door and yells for Tim to give the baby back, and Tim wouldn't do it. At this point, because of the gunfire in the apartment, the SWAT team's alerted, and they come out, and you have a traditional SWAT standoff. And at that point, there were several phone calls that Tim made with the SWAT team, made some phone calls to family members. And what he said he was going to do, he was going to punish Emma by killing Tim, the baby, and killing himself. And the reason being, he claimed that he'd been abused and his wife had been real bad to him, and he went through a litany of things that he claimed that his wife had done. And so what he did at that point, in these various phone calls, he was screaming and yelling what a no-good, rotten woman this woman was. Now she had ruined his life. Now he was not going to let him separate him from his child, nor would he want him, if he'd go to prison for shooting at her, did he want her rearing this child. So his plan, apparently, was to kill the baby and then kill himself.
Commit suicide. Can you hold up here,
sure.
Lizzie? Gloria, are you back? Gloria.
Yes.
What's going on?
Well, the execution is happening. Timothy Adams' family went in. His minister, his mom and dad, his sister and his brother, and his employer all walked in. So the it's okay. Happening now.
So we had a delay of about almost 10 minutes before the normal crossing. And then how much after the media did the witnesses go across?
Let me see, what time is it? I guess about 15 minutes. We don't know what caused that delay, but they're all in there. They went in there just a few minutes ago.
Okay, so this is running about a quarter of the time behind, because often we have them filing back across by now.
Right. No, it'll be probably another 20 minutes.
Okay, Gloria, we're gonna come back to you for coverage locally when you have something else to report. But this is a pretty serious story, and Jim's doing a very fine job of explaining to folks.
All right, and also when we call back, you can talk with Juan.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Gloria.
All righty. Bye bye.
Okay. And again, that was Gloria Ruback, who is a regular voice here on Execution Watch. She is at the Death House in Huntsville, observing what is going there. We also have had a report from Dave Atwood, who is at the vigil here in Houston, which is tonight at the Big Methodist Church at the corner of Main and Benz. We continue with Jim Skelton, because Jim, What does it seem like? It seemed like it just kind of went berserk.
You see a lot of this in marriages, and when people get divorced and separated, it's not, I'm not saying it's real common, but it's not unusual for a husband to want to kill himself and kill the whole family. That's pretty typical. I mean, I hate to say that, but that happens fairly often. And during this SWAT standoff, he, in fact, shoots his 19-month-old baby. Shoots him twice in the chest, shoots him once, he doesn't die, shoots him a second time, then he dies. And then apparently his plan was to kill himself because he wrote a note after he killed the baby. And the note primarily was directed as a diatribe of anger and hatred toward his wife at how mean she was to him and all the various things she did do and did not do. And he kept calling her all sorts of names during the note and what a no good she was and how he was trying to punish her. In fact, when I was talking to Susan Ashley about this, I want to get her perspective on it. When she read the note, she felt like probably he shot the baby perhaps as revenge, retaliation to make his wife feel badly. And I think his plan was to kill himself, but at this time the SWAT team gets in touch with him, starts talking to him, and really talk him out of the house. And what happened when he gets with the SWAT team, he agrees to make a tape recording and explain to them what happened. And the SWAT team pretty well let him run his head. And the first part of the tape was just a diatribe about what a no good woman she was. And a lot of the things he complained about when it was played for the jury, I'm sure sounded trite. For example, he complained that he bought her a Mother's Day card. She didn't open it. Complained he didn't sing happy birthday to him. Complained he wouldn't go out with him, with them to have dinner on Mother's Day. And a lot of those things, I'm sure to a jury, it seemed somewhat trite, that not worth killing somebody over. And, on the other hand, Gloria at trial testified primarily for the state because the only thing they had left to do after he entered a plea of guilty was the punishment part.
Yeah.
And she testified that he was violent toward her, claimed at one time that he was very suspicious and jealous of her, worried about her messing around with other men. And she told an event about one time she called a co-worker on the phone and he grabbed the phone and tried to slap her around and hit her and things like that because her version was a good deal different than his. And most of his anger was directed primarily in the note he wrote at his wife. So things that really hurt him in front of the jury, number one, was that note that he wrote, because the note was directed primarily at his wife. Secondly, the tape recording, a lot of the things he complained about, I don't think would impress a jury as things that would drive you over the brink to want to kill your only 19-month-old baby. And apparently he was, according to some of the witnesses, was somewhat dispassionate about the fact that he killed his child. Didn't apparently show a lot of remorse because he was apparently more angry at the wife than he was remorseful for killing the baby. So, and from it comes from a lawyer viewpoint, here you have an instance where a man admits on tape. In fact, one of the phone calls to one of the family members, he told one of the family friends he already killed his son. So you had statements made to the police. You had a tape recording of it. The jury could hear his voice. And the explanations, complaints he made about his wife were not particularly earth-shattering.
Did he take the stand during the punishment?
Doesn't say in the opinions. I'm assuming he didn't. I don't have any earthly idea.
I mean, what in the world could he have further confessed to?
Probably nothing else.
So he had absolutely nothing to lose by not taking this.
I would have thought they'd have put him on the stand, let him show some emotion, because one of the things that apparently hurt him, where the police testified he seemed to be more angry about his wife than remorse for killing his only child. Well, not his only child. He had another child by prior relationship. For killing this 19-month-old baby. And what they did, this is one of the issues on appeal when it finally went to the different appellate courts. The big issue was there was no evidence of future dangerousness. And Kathy Cochran wrote the opinion. And they did basically the same thing in this case they did the O'Brien case. They said you can take the facts of this case, and anybody who would kill his own flesh and blood would be a danger to society in the future. Because that's basically what they did with the Larry O'Brien case. And then what happened, they, on the punishment issues, some of the clemency things complained about the lawyers because they called a great deal of character witnesses. They called a clinical psychiatrist. They called they even called people at the jail who testified in his behalf because he never, ever, ever had any problems at the jail. He's never had a disciplinary problem on death row. No one's ever said an ill word about him at all in all of this time. And he had a bunch of fellow employees that testified as character witnesses. But the big complaint was there was only one member of the family that was called to testify, and that was his mother. And they said later, at least, of course, you can always in hindsight look at things, that the jury didn't have the benefit that he had a stable home, a stable background, been reared in a church. And in fact, two of the jurors who served on the jury said, had this evidence been developed, they would have voted against the death penalty. And they wrote this in the clemency proceeding that,
but that didn't work.
Didn't work. And so,
well, the lawyers really didn't have much to work with after the initial trial, because there is no issue of guilt or innocence. There's no issue of sufficiency of the evidence.
None.
There's no evidence of anything. All you have is what is heard at punishment.
Right, and what they tried to argue, of course, that he wouldn't be a danger to the future. Another thing they brought up is kind of interesting. There was a case mentioned, I think, in the newspaper today about a case out of Beaumont where a woman killed her two children. And they gave her the death penalty, but the Court of Criminal Appeals in that case reversed it, saying there was no future dangers to the community because the danger is directed toward the children. And they tried to parallel that case to this case. The problem is, in this case, the anger was directed toward the wife, and he shot at the wife and probably would have killed her if he'd have been a good shot. Because the first shot he fired was toward the wife. And so that's one of the things that distinguishes this case from the one in which a woman had killed her children. They said that her anger was directed, not her anger, but her problems were directed toward the children. And she had life in prison. She wasn't likely to have children. And that was the theory behind reversing that case for insufficient evidence on future dangerousness. I think what really hurt him in this case was the note he wrote. His attitude, most of his anger was about his wife rather than be remorseful about killing his baby.
Where did this case happen?
Harris County.
Janine it happened
Barr.
Right here in Houston.
Janine Barr was the judge. He was born and reared here in Houston. And Janine Barr was the judge. They had another issue on when they were playing, because as you well know, when you pay these tape recordings, it's a confession, and the question is, were they voluntarily made? And of course, the court ruled that it was obviously voluntarily. And at one time during his tape recorded statement, he requested a lawyer. And when that occurs, they're supposed to quit questioning and not question again unless the defendant himself wants to reinitiate the conversation.
Yeah.
And he did that. And those were the only issues on appeal. And the only big issue in this case is there sufficient evidence to show he'd be a danger to the community if he had been given a life sentence? And like I say, had he not directed so much anger and hatred toward his wife, that might very well have won the day. Had he not shot at the wife first, that very well would have won the day. But truthfully, and I was debating this with Susan when I had her read the summary, I do not think this would be a death penalty case today. If this happened today in Harris County, I don't think they'd seek the death penalty. I think that they would not probably seek capital murder and waive the death penalty as a life without parole. Because here you've got a guy with no criminal record, come from a stable background, honorable discharge from the Army, worked as a security guard, had an exemplary employment record, people seemed to like him real well. The only one that spoke ill of him at trial was the wife, who talked about him being jealous and possessive, and a friend of the wife who testified she'd intervene, and she basically repeated what the wife had told her. And really all she knew is what the wife said. And the fact that another problem he had to explain, and you'll write, I'll take it back, I need to retract. He did, in fact, testify at trial, because they asked him about buying the guns, and he claimed he bought the guns for deer hunting. The problem is, deer season was about 9 months off when he bought the pistol, and you don't normally go deer hunting with a pistol.
No, I've never. I read that, and I thought, you don't kill Bambi with a. Bambi can't shoot back, so it's not a shot off on.
You have a big.
But he was a security guard.
I understand.
And don't most of those people, if they're not allowed to carry a gun, don't they covet them?
Well, this is Tony Greenway Plaza. I'm not sure they'd let you carry a gun.
Okay.
Now, it might have been if you had some place other than Greenway Plaza, but I think the things that hurt him, in this case, was that the anger toward his wife. I think that's what, if he would have been more remorseful about killing his baby. But I just can't imagine. I was shocked when they're carried through this case, because it's not, you and I both know, we handle these cases, or we talk about these cases all the time, and this is not what I hate
to say. Now, this one is, it's cost the state a good bit of money to get this far with this case.
Of course. Of course.
And it's they're running out of chemicals. And so this is a very special occasion if they're going to pull the chemicals that they use to execute people in Texas.
Interesting, Ray. We had on a program last week that we were talking about the cost of this, and there's a county called Waller County north of here.
Yep.
And the commissioners, when they realized how much it costs to kill somebody, they said, we could buy a new road grader for that. We'd rather have a road grader than a capital murder case. And they've never had a capital murder.
And they've never had a capital murder. In
Waller,
what county?
Waller County, but they've had a lot of road graders. But yeah, they've never had a capital murder case.
They've had a lot of water road graders.
Yeah.
We do not mean to make light of the death of Timothy Adams. The speaker that has brought us up to date is Jim Skelton. Jim Skelton is an experienced attorney, native Texan. He has served on both sides of the bar as prosecutor and as a defense attorney, and he's somewhat of a legend among local criminal defense attorneys because of the quality of his fine work. We're going to go to Gloria. Gloria, you back with us?
Ray?
Yes.
Well, apparently the execution has happened. The media came out, but the family hasn't come. Oh, well, wait.
You're the
guy. No, the family hasn't come out, but I guess it's happened since the media has come
out. Yeah, if the media filed across the street, they have something to report, and so that's going out. The family will come out, and traditionally what happens is that the family witnesses then scurry off to the Huntsville funeral home,
right,
where they can visit with the folks there while the body's still warm. I know that sounds morbid, but at this point in time, everything has already been lost. And to
here comes the family.
Here comes the family.
Oh, my God.
Well, I understand that you have with you Mr. Melendez.
Yes, I do. Let me walk back across the street.
Okay, while she is going to Petra, and let me tell you that originally we had scheduled a guest of Anthony Green, but Anthony Graves, but he was advised by his attorneys to be careful because he's got pending litigation. One minute, Melendez.
Correct.
My name is Ray Hill, and I understand that you are a survivor of this brutal system and process from Florida.
That's right.
Is it that they just don't like Puerto Ricans there, or tell us about this?
Well, my case was based on the testimony of two questionable witnesses. They don't have no physical evidence against me. One person say that I confessed the crime to him, and then implicates a friend of mine, and they threatened him with the electric chair, and he testified against me and say that he took me to the place with the murderer occurred, and that was it. Then 16 years later, they find a videotape of the confession of the real killer, and they did an investigation, and they find out that I did not do the crime, and they let me go after I spent 17 years, 8 months, and 1 day in death row.
Actually, according to the information I have, that the prosecutors had access to the correct information even before you were convicted.
Even before I was convicted, but I was the one where they found the evidence that I did not commit the crime 1 month before trial, but I'm the one indicted. I'm the one that the prosecutor say that I did it. He had told the reporters that they would sing the death penalty against me. And when the evidence came that I did not do it, that they had information that I did not do it, I was already indicted all my way to go to trial. It was no turning back. Why? Because I'm a Puerto Rican.
Apparently, in Florida in the 1980s.
Yeah, 1984.
1984. Actually, we have found out that a lot of erroneous convictions were happening.
Exactly. Florida lead the nation on incinerations with 26. The next state will be Illinois with 20.
And then Texas comes in there pretty soon because they have all those cases that were overturned because of DNA out of Dallas.
Yeah, and Texas got 11 incineries from their row.
Well,
so Texas is no different from any other state, and they kill more than any state. Today, Texas, with this that happened today, today Texas number is 466. Has been 1,241 executions, a third of them from the state of Texas. So this is a killing state. This is the belly of the beast.
Mr. Melendez, you, of course, were on death row for 17 years. Is that correct?
I was in death row, to be precisely, 17 years, 8 months, and 1 day.
And during that period of time, you saw people leave the row to go to the chamber.
Exactly. When I went over there, they executed 10 persons. When I leave, 51. So I witnessed 41 executed, 41 friends of mine.
What is the atmosphere like on the row when that happens?
Say that again, my friend.
What is the atmosphere on the row like when someone is taken from your group and carried to the chamber?
It's the saddest thing for me. And death row was when they execute someone. See, I'm in this cell. Next to me is another person that's been sent to death just like me, that I know for 10 or 15 years. He cries in my shoulders. I cry in his. He shared with me his most intimate thoughts. I share mine with him. I learned to grow up to love him. And one day they snatch him out of that cell. I know what's going to happen. In my time, it's the electric chair. They got to generate the chair with electricity because it's 2,010 volts that got to go to his body for them to get him legally killed. And I can hear this bossy sound, that still stay in my mind. And I know precisely the time when they burn the life out of him because the lights go flip on and off. So I know that's the time when they burn the life on him, when they kill him. And the saddest thing for me is that some of them are innocent, like Jesse Tefaro, Benny Dems, Leo Jones, Pedro Medina. And my homeboy from Puerto Rico that the state of Florida in a plea bargain offered him 5 years. He did not took it simply because he did not commit the crime and it cost him his life and his nearest dears. And all I can say, my friend, is I see you soon. And that was the saddest part of me in there. When they execute, when the government legally kills somebody.
One, how do you maintain sanity in that madness?
I maintain sanity because when I went to death row, I did not know how to read, I did not know how to write, I did not know how to speak English. And the condemned men, the worst of the worst, the ones that the prosecutor called monsters, the most indescribable people in the nation, taught these Puerto Ricans how to read, how to write, how to speak English, told me some law, and told me in a way to let hate and anger go and fight in a peaceful way. That's the thing that people need to learn. Even the ones that are guilty, you're not killing a monster. You're killing people that have changed for the better. You're killing a human being.
Juan,
that's why we got to get rid of it.
Juan, for the first time in over a year that we have done this show, people on Texas death row can directly hear your voice.
Thank you, amigo.
Do you have a message for your brothers?
Oh, yes, I do. I would tell them to never lose hope. Keep strong. Reply the letters that pen pals write them. And keep the spirit high. I know it's not easy, but it's ways. Always find a way to do something. Clean the cell, do something. There's no let depression get you. And never lose your hope. Keep on thinking that one day something good will come out. And help the family to keep themselves strong too, because they also suffer. I spent 17 years, 8 months and 1 day in death row. My mama spent 17 years, 8 months and 1 day on her knees praying for a miracle. So keep the hope and I would like them to know there is a lot of people fighting for them. They're not alone. We will get rid of this. We will get rid of the death penalty. It will get abolished. The question is, the time when it's going to happen. But it will happen.
Juana, thank you very much for joining us. Could you put Gloria back on the phone, please?
Okay.
This has been a really unique experience to me. I suddenly realized during Juan's broadcast that there were people on Texas death row that could hear this show for the very first time. Tonight is a very unique experience. We have moved from the HD2 channel to this broadcast channel.
Oh, okay.
Gloria?
Yeah.
For the first time since we have been doing this show, there are people sitting on death row that are hearing our voice.
Wow.
And I think that is a very grave responsibility. I ask Juan to share a message to his brothers. You have many friends on death row. You have any comment to make at this point?
I have many friends on death row. I've lost many friends who are on death row. And I just want to tell the guys to, you know, stay strong and what does Jesse Jackson say? Keep hope alive, because you never know what's going to happen. There are more and more people opposed to the death penalty. There's less death sentences signed down, and I think we're seeing the beginning of the end of this. I just wish it would come immediately.
I think officially they're out of chemicals with this one.
They're out of what?
Chemicals.
Yeah.
So we don't know.
No, we don't.
Gloria, this has been a very well used up hour. Timothy is dead.
He is dead. His family is devastated. I'm getting ready to go over to the hospitality house so they can give me information about funeral arrangements. And it's just a very, very sad night. And for me as an activist, what's so sad is that I know this thing's coming to an end. I mean, I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago when we were in the heyday, but it's coming to an end, and yet in 2 months or a month and a half or whatever, Sarge is scheduled for execution. I don't know what's going to happen with the doggone drug dilemma.
There is a very famous speech by a former United States military lower officer who is now a senator from Massachusetts. And how do you explain to the last person who dies in this war what it was all about? How do you explain to the last person executed in this state about its having been abolished after they are executed? These are very grave and very serious times. These are very strong political issues for the listeners of this radio program. Would you please give a message to Juan for me? Tell Juan that if any of the guys on the row wish to respond to his message, they can send that letter to radio station KPFT in care of Execution Watch, 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. And we will in turn share that information with Juan if he will stay in touch.
Okay, yeah, I have his email and phone number and all that. So
okay, well,
that is no problem. And, you know, I want to let people know that there's an alternative spring break, an anti-death penalty spring break in Austin every year. I just handed out flyers to about 10 or 15 students and invited them to come. And one of the things it says on the webpage is, during spring break, you can go to the beach for a week and change your frame of mind, or you can come to Austin and help change the world. So I encourage anybody who's listening who is a student to go to alternativespringbreak.org/deathpenalty and check it out.
Do you have dates?
It's always the week of St. Patrick's Day. I'm thinking
St. Patrick's Day weekend.
It's actually Monday through Thursday. I think it's like the 14th to the 17th or something like that.
Okay, Gloria.
Of March. Okay, well, thanks, Ray, very much. I appreciate what you do, and I'm tickled that people on around death row and our whole listening audience is able to hear this. Because when people say, well, what's a normal execution like? I said, well, there's never a normal execution. There's always something unique about the case, about the person, about the dynamics that happen out here in Huntsville. And tonight it was very emotional because the family was out here with us. We have Barcelona TV here interviewing some of our members who are Spanish-speaking from Colombia, from Mexico, and from Venezuela. So there's always something happening out here, and I'm glad people were able to share that with us tonight.
And Gloria, how do people get in touch with you and your organization?
AbolitionMovement.org.
AbolitionMovement.org. Thank you, Gloria Ruback.
Okay. Thanks, Ray. Bye-bye.
Our vigilant is Gloria Ruback, who is, she have been on this picket line for a long time. I've known Gloria for a good many years. I am a little bit overwhelmed because Elizabeth has sent me a note that I am sorely mistaken about how long we have been doing Execution Watch. We've been doing Execution Watch for nearly 3 years. This has been how many executions we've covered? Do you have any hint?
Oh. That I don't know. I will go and find out, though.
Okay, we have covered a good many. It is 6:49. We're going to sign off about at 0:58. So we've got a few more minutes to go here. I would like to point out that Timothy Williams is dead. Timothy Adams is dead. He is at the Huntsville Funeral Home. His family has gone by the hospitality house, which is provided by the First Baptist Church of Huntsville, where the families await good and bad news for their loved one.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, Ray, but I wanted to point out that one of the reasons that people are so eager to rush to the funeral home to touch the body is that all the while that the person has been on death row, they have not been able to touch that person.
They've not been able to touch that person at all in Texas, which is different rules for different states. But in Texas, there is no touching. And it still has some warmth to it. And I know that sounds morbid, but I have an obligation to report that every time we do this show. Jim Skelton has been in studio with us, and he told us the story of what happened in this case and did the best he could explaining what happened in the appellate process, but there wasn't much going on.
Well, there wasn't a whole lot. I mean, really, like I say, it's a dice roll when you do this. When you enter a plea of guilty, the good part is you have at least some credibility with the jury when you're saying you're guilty and you show some remorse. That's the good part of it. The bad part of it is you haven't got a whole lot left to appeal because you waived.
Lawyers have pretty much denied their routine.
But the truth of the matter is, Ray, if you did this on a not guilty plea, the evidence of guilt was absolutely overwhelming, and the issues probably would have been the same anyway because you have the statement he made to the friend of the family, admitted the killing. He had the gun in his hand when the police came in, and he made a tape-recorded statement to the police about it.
So all of the things that are normally issues in this case were just not there.
Not there at all. All you could argue, and that's the best you can do, is argue the confession wasn't voluntary. And really the big issue is, like it was the Lawrence O'Brien case, was there evidence he'd be a danger to the community? And it's almost ludicrous to think, with his background, what he had gone through, that he'd come back to Houston and be a danger to anybody. Now, of course, Emma might argue with us about
sure.
that. But, you know, Warren Wise would probably think everybody's a danger to the community. There's nothing
Andy Kahn
about that. That's absolutely.
Andy Kahn. Shoplifters should be executed because they're a danger to the community.
But this is absolutely, there is absolutely no evidence that he was a danger to anybody, period. And it's horrible that people can have to pay for how irrational they are during a divorce, as you well know in talking and counseling people. People are at their worst when they're going through a divorce or when there's a death in the family. And they're not rational. I mean, some of the things that we all pull when we separate from our spouses, someone we've been with, we're not in a rational state of mind. And we do some nutty, crazy things that we later regret. And like I say, the thing that really, really hurt him, I think, in this case was the fact that was so angry at his wife, he showed no emotion for the death of his baby. And I think the jury might have thought he killed the baby to get back. Like Susan Ashley has at least said to me, she thought that
she had it all figured out.
I get her viewpoint on things because she's from New York and from Connecticut.
You got Susan. A couple of minutes here, Susan. This is Susan Ashley, who is also a practicing attorney.
It seems to me that where it's very chilling is that he associates clearly the child with the mother. He clearly wanted to kill the mother. He shot at the mother. Her son tried to protect her. They got out the door. After they're out the door, the 18-month-old baby is left there with them. her son knocks on the door and pounds on the door and tries to get him to give up the baby, his 18-month-old child. He doesn't. If his plan was to kill himself, he could have gave up the child and killed himself.
Sure.
He could have said to his wife, I'll show you, I'll kill myself.
Well, you know, a lot of things happened in divorces. I mean, there are people doing loads of time for being sex offenders for made-up stories because nobody wanted justice. They wanted to get even.
Right.
And I guess it's one of the... out there in the universal ether, if you think you're immune from having to deal with the system in very strange and different ways, you're not as absent of vulnerability as you think you are.
Well, you know what they basically did is execute the man for being irrational during a divorce.
That's
if
right.
you executed everybody that was irrational during a divorce, you'd solve the population problem.
Yeah. Overnight.
Exactly.
Okay, now Susan...
But...
Okay.
If you... Every man that was angry at his wife or felt his wife treated him terribly doesn't kill their child, okay? I mean, that's the problem. He had every opportunity to let the child go. If he wanted to kill himself, he could have killed himself.
Sure.
There were people pounding on the door saying, let the child go.
I noticed.
He was, you know, I mean, you could argue that he was mentally so twisted and sick over this, you know, whatever divorce, that he couldn't separate the child from the mother.
Susan, I've noticed that people who kill people before killing themselves always kill the other people first.
Well, they kill themselves. It'd be an Aggie joke, you know.
That's right.
You know, they pull a gun in his head and says, don't laugh, you're next, you know. It's always that way.
Yeah, right. My name is Ray Hill, and the voice you just got through hearing is Jim Skelton. And with us in the studio is Susan Ashley. This is Execution Watch, and it is a premier live broadcast on broadcast channel and HD1 of radio station KPFT Houston of this show. We've been doing the show for 3 years. All of our previous shows are available on archive. In other words, you can go to executionwatch.org, and in there somewhere is every execution that we have covered on this show. We began over about 3 years ago discussing the need for this show because executions were happening very frequently in Houston and Texas, and there was relatively little attention paid to them. This was our little anecdote of putting what is going on in your head. And we've had to do this in kind of a roundabout way because we didn't have access to KPFT's broadcast channel. Thanks to the management, that changes with this show. The producer of the show has, since the very beginning, been Elizabeth Ann Stein. And I walked into the studio just seconds before this show and handed a fistful of notes, so I am merely entertainment here. My name is Ray Hill, and I am the host. We could not do this show without the technical wizardry and the maintenance of our website, Otis McClay, who has been in broadcasting for a good many years, began his Houston career on The Prison Show, and is now a real honcho in the world of Pacifica Foundation. The engineer tonight was Greg Alexander, and this is the first time Greg has worked with us. Thank you, Greg, for being with us. The theme music that we play is by Victoria Panetti, and you can hear some of her other work if you go to myspace.com/SheMonster, and I'll let you make of that what you wish to. My name is Ray Hill. You can get my background in history and other information about me on theprisonshow.org. Thank you for listening to Execution Watch. Our next scheduled execution is Cleve Sarge Foster, former decorated military personnel from real war. And we'll see what happens then. That is scheduled for April the 5th. This is Ray Hill. Good night.
Live where you long. Pacifica National Board will have its next quarterly in-person meeting in Houston, and all KPFT listeners are invited to attend. The meeting starts Friday morning, February the 25th, and goes until Sunday afternoon, February the 27th. Public comment and other open public sessions will be held each day. The meeting will be held at the Four Point Sheraton, 2828 Southwest Freeway at Wake Forest, Houston, Texas, 77098. The draft agenda, streaming information, and other details will be available at Pacifica.org before the meeting. This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.